And what are the things that you have seen in the clinic?
So I grew up in Russia. We also have a self-medicating tradition called vodka. It's and I think that yeah. actually kind of brings me back a little bit to what you and I were talking about.
Hi, and welcome back to the Gastronauts Podcast. My name is Peter, and I'll be your host. Here at Gastronauts, we are committed to exploring communication throughout the body with a particular focus on the crosstalk between gut and brain. We have a special episode today for you all. We previously held a Zoom side chat around self-medication within animals, curated by Dr. Diego Borges, and we would like to share this discussion with you.
I'm very excited to introduce friends, Gastronauts friends from Asia, from Europe, and from the United States for this first edition of a Gastronauts online version of what a conversation should be around a topic that seems to be relevant to these days. So we have from Inuyama joining us, Mike Hoffman. Mike is a primatologist, and in fact, I think that by reading some of his work is that I got even deeper into this interest of why it is that humans and animals will undergo self-medication. And then we have joining us from the University of Oxford, Dr. Ana Domingos. She did her PhD and postdoctoral fellowship at the Rockefeller University. And in fact, today she's joining us from Lisbon, right? Ana has been doing some pioneering work around the reward of nutrients, how it is that nutrients make us feel well. And now in her laboratory at Oxford University, she studies the communication between fat and the brain. And joining us from Mayo Clinic, it looks very green on that side, judging by the background, our friend Art Bader. So Art is a physician scientist and a true innovator. In fact, how I met Art, it was we were on the line to dinner at a Keystone meeting on optogenetics in, I believe it was 2014. And I think that we were both asking ourselves, like, what are we doing here, like optogenetics and the gut? And it sounded a little bit esoteric, but now it actually probably makes a lot of sense for a lot of people here. So Art recently got awarded a New Innovator Award, and he is actually a physician scientist that is studying mechanosensation, or the sense of touch, at the Mayo Clinic. So welcome and thank you for joining us. I know that in the case of Anna, I think that is almost 9 p.m. or something like that in Portugal. And in the case of Mike, it's 5 a.m. in Japan. So thank you for making the effort to join us. So Mike, tell us, how it is that someone gets interested in animals that know how to use medicine? Is it because it makes them feel good? Like, is it medicine that something that over healing, we are looking to the satisfaction of feeling better, feeling good?
Exactly. So, well, it all goes back to the idea of homeostasis, whether basically, everything that an animal puts in its mouth has some kind of feedback mechanism. I believe if it's fruit, you get quick energy. You realize that the difference really quick, and you can move on throughout your day. But there are some times when you crave something different. Most primates, for example, will have a diet of up to 170. Sometimes more different plants that they'll eat across the year. So there's seasonality that it influences what they eat. But there are some things that are non-seasonal, but they're only used during certain seasons. And that's one of the things that caught my attention to what may be different about the diet. Most plant feeding ecologists look at why animals avoid some things and what their searching for a positive feedback. It could be proteins, carbohydrates, sugars, things like that. But there's all these secondary plant compounds in there that people have spent a long time explaining why animals don't eat those things. But occasionally an animal will eat something that is full of things that are non-nutritious. And I stumbled onto this when I was studying chimpanzees in Western Tanzania. Part of what I was doing was just day-to-day recording of what they were eating, but I had no idea about medicine or illness. But I was working with a traditional healer. He had been on the team since 1965, and he was trained by his mother, his grandmother, his grandfather, many, many generations of people who looked at the plants from a different perspective. But he was also a hunter from his young age, so he knew the animal behavior, everything very well. He was born in that forest. But we were doing a completely different study. He was basically my tracker to keep me from getting lost in this forest and avoid snakes and leopards and all of these things. But one day we came across an animal that was behaving a little bit different, but I didn't think much about it until I asked him what she was eating. And that started this whole study that's been going on now for almost 30 plus years. And he said, well, it's very bitter. And me being part, well, we're all part monkey. I would put everything in my mouth that the chimps would put in their mouth just to understand what they were eating and what their sense of taste was, because it's completely different across different species of primates because they have different taste receptors. But when Mohammadi said that this is also very important medicine for us, then I began thinking back at what I'd seen that morning in that individual, and a lot of things were different. So it opened up my eyes to differences in their health. And so I thought, well, if they don't eat this plant very often, I'd never seen it. I'd studied the group for almost 12 months up to that time, over two different study periods. So it's something they don't eat very often, and it's something that tastes different from what they normally eat. And then with the added information from Mohammadi that this is a very important medicine for them, then I began to study sickness, take records each day of all the individuals we would follow, look at the fecal content, stool type. And then I started a parasitology project to look at host-parasite interactions. And then all of these things, the diet, the dietary changes, and the effects of eating some of these different plants really jumped out at me. And it began this study to look in not just chimpanzees, but all across the board, all different types of animals, and ethnomedicine as well. But basically, back to your question, people, animals, we all choose what we eat as according to how it makes us feel. If we're hungry, we get something that we know will fill us up. If we're tired, we get something that we know will perk us up. If it's early in the morning, we'll get a cup of coffee because we know the caffeine will help us start our engines. But when we're sick, we tend to look for something different. And if we're based in a tradition, like primates have a cultural tradition of what things you eat, when and how you process those things, humans have the same thing, then under this cultural guidance, things begin to be categorized or have different meanings, I guess. So part of what we're doing is trying to look at all of that in any of the primates that we study.
So I'm Brianna. I'm a grad student here at Duke in Durham, North Carolina. What I was wondering is for Michael, do you think that there are any similar sources of bias or confounding when you're drawing conclusions from primate populations, or do we work under the assumption that they are not able, or they are not prone to placebo effect in the same ways that we are?
Very good question. We use the animal data for a non-biased biocultural explanation sometimes for what they're doing, what their choices are. I think humans are psychologically tuned into to things beyond the organic that makes a placebo affects more prevalent perhaps, but primates, when they select things, they're very, very conservative. We don't see them randomly trying a bunch of different things when they're not looking like they feel well. So I think they're basing their decisions more on gut feelings and what they've, and those gut feelings are expressed from nature according to what they've been, what they've learned is edible within their environment. They're very conservative. They don't eat things that the rest of the group don't eat, especially the young infants. That's where they learn within the first year what their group eats, what is edible in their habitat. So I think we can ignore the placebo effect, but if there was information about that, there's a lot of cognitive biologists, ecologists that would love to dig into that with animals, but I don't see any kind of evidence that suggests that that's going on in the species that I've looked at anyway.
Mike, so the self-medication that you see in your monkeys, is it promoted by the group? So it's a learning, they need to learn, or is it, or if you put the monkey in a cage and they never experience from the group, they would learn themselves how to self-medicate?
The biological component, I think, is driven by taste. So if you have an animal that has never had exposure to a natural habitat or to the culture of a group, they may be selecting things from what they have based on taste or smell. I think that's what is what guides them. But within a group, they always, you know, they're always consistent in what's eaten, especially for treatment of parasites. We're just beginning to look at other kinds of abnormalities or imbalances that they may be using plants for reproduction, for stress, things like that. There is definitely a biological component. There is that component. Even if they're not raised in a cultural environment, they will probably be making similar decisions if they were able to select from different types of taste. But in nature, what you take and how you use it is all within a cultural, a social learning context for primates.
Fascinating. And that's how a human gets into understanding behavior of animals, through observation and I guess storytelling too. And I can tell you, I'm going to tell you a quick story. So the first thing is, before I jump onto the how I got interested on these, I do want to say one thing about the actual definition of medicine. And I see here from the Oxford Dictionary, there are two definitions, and I'm gonna read you. I feel like both are a little bit similar. But the second one, it says, a compound or preparation used for the treatment or prevention of disease, especially a drug or drugs taken by mouth. And I think that is it is important to run the definition because in chatting with Art, we did have a little bit of a conversation around why it is that for different people it means different things. So I think that is important to have that definition. And I will tell you that I got very interested in this subject because I grew up in the Ecuadorian Amazonia, and in the Ecuadorian Amazonia, there is this plant called guayusa, and I have some of that here. And it's like a tea, is Ilex guayusa. It is a cousin of the Ilex paraguayensis or the yerba mate.
I like it.
It's very light, very smooth. And of course, I grew up exposed to it, and you will just be like, oh, that's just guayusa, right? And at some point, I had the opportunity to hear from a friend that he's a native of the Ecuadorian Amazonia. And I said, why do you guys take guayusa? Because it's very prevalent among them. And actually, I learned that it only grows in that part of like the Ecuador, north of Peru, south of Colombia, but it's pretty much Ecuador. And he said that they take it for three reasons. They take it for energy, so it actually suppresses appetite. They take it for pain. It helps them to work longer and not feel the pain, the muscular pain. And the third reason, they said They actually drink it as a way of socializing. So in the tribes, apparently, like, they get together around 4 a.m. Around Tokyo time, and they heat up the wayusa, and then they have it and have these conversations around the fire, and that's how they plan the day. And that is actually a plan that it is very popular in the Ecuadorian Amazonia. So I would like to bring back the conversation to our friend Art. And do you know if any? Well, it looks like it is prevalent, these self-medication behaviors, so to speak, around these patients. Do you know what kind of do they use plants? What kind of what are the most common things that people will try?
So I have to go back and read a little bit more about what self-medication. What's really interesting is that I read some of Mike's work, and it's just absolutely fascinating. In terms of how animals, discover and perpetuate these habits and these behaviors. And then if you think about how we in America think about self-medication, most of us will think about it as a negative behavior, right? As some sort of a drug use and covering up some of the psychiatric problems. So I think it's important for us to establish the differences between, the healthy habits of self-medication as opposed to the abusive powers as that we might come across, whether it's in literature or media or otherwise. So I think that's an important distinction to be made, because there, where I grew up, we certainly had lots of, folk type of approaches to common ailments that, I was wondering about how we even pass these kinds of, traditions along. How do we remember this? How do we know this? There's oftentimes some truth to this. It's interesting, the GI system, the gastroenterology system, we see a lot of this type of self-medicating behavior, and as Diego was saying. What's interesting is that, having gone through internal medicine, you don't see as much of that. This is completely circumstantial, but I don't feel like you see as much of that in other areas. There's a disease called interstitial cystitis, where people have bladder pain for reasons that we still don't understand. It's kind of like irritable bowel syndrome, but of the bladder. And we don't see folks doing the same types of things and the same types of behaviors as they do when they come to the gastroenterology clinic. And literally anything and everything, the new trend that we are sort of seeing a lot of is the microbiome, right? And probiotics, prebiotics, kombucha. I mean, people drink gallons of kombucha now.
Ashton, right? Is a big believer in kombucha. And so is Winston, I believe.
And I don't know, man. I tip my hat off to people who drink this stuff, because I can't get past the taste of it for me. But again, I mean, it's a combination of these things. And you have people who come and they say, look, I took probiotics and it is the most magical thing I've ever done. That's about a third of the people. About a third of the people say, I took probiotics and I've never felt worse. And about a third of the people say, I think I just flushed my money down the drain. So the big question for us is, clearly it's working for some folks. The reasons for this, I don't know, right? How do we find that out? How do we find out how do we identify the groups of people? What do we look for? What is the kind of stuff that, we'd be thinking about in terms of really predicting responses of our patients to these different things? Because what's really difficult for a lot of them is, if you've got chronic abdominal pain, it's often disabling in a way where young people, 20-year-old women, are not able to work or go to school, and disability. And the last answer you want to do is, how about we give you 30 different types of things that you'll try for 2 months each, and maybe one of them will work, right? So some of that decision-making would be good to be guided by science, right? To go back to your question, we try everything, right? I mean, I would say that our medicines currently are probably not much better than some of the traditional folk stuff that we've thought about, peppermint, caraway, being really good examples that are very, very effective in a good proportion of patients with chronic abdominal pain and IBS.
I'm joining from my home office in Durham. Okay, so question is, the self-medication pattern of people, has that changed since CBD products have become more available and also more popular use of kratom or kratom? Has that changed people's self-medication behavior, especially for the entire box or the entire basket of inflammatory bowel disorder?
What's kratom?
Or kratom.
Kratom. It's an herbal preparation that has also that has opioid activity, but it's an herbal mix where some of the ingredient of that herbal mix is activating opioid receptors. That is how it has come into the crosshairs of regulators, for example, in the US, that have rung the alarm bell that people are using oxycodone, and so they're addicted, they use more and more, and then they use kratom in addition because they cannot get more pills. And then the kratom, the question is kratom driving them into respiratory failure or other really bad things? But then has kratom also been used by people outside this opioid problem that is still around?
Yeah, I could try to be to answer the CBD. I'm much more familiar with the other one. I'm not, though. I think it sort of joins a host of different compounds that folks have used for chronic pain. I can speak for our experience in Minnesota, right? So CBD is something that's maybe an offshoot of the whole marijuana movement, right? We've had marijuana legalized for medical purposes. And in fact, one of the indications that it's approved for is inflammatory bowel disease and really pain associated with it. For mm-hmm. functional GI diseases, the data are either non-existent or very weak for marijuana or CBD products to be effective in functional GI disorders. In fact, what's really interesting, and one of the things that I thought about as I was kind of thinking about this, is marijuana use, has been pretty widespread, but now folks are beginning to talk about it. There is a functional GI disease called hyperemesis syndrome, where chronic marijuana users will develop essentially irretractable vomiting, that they will have basically what looks to be sort of consistent vomiting. And the one thing that these folks do for self-medication is hot showers. So you take a hot shower, and to me it was a really interesting thing. I saw a patient, and she said, "Look, I got vomiting and nausea, and I can't seem to get rid of this." And you're always like, "Well, do you take hot showers?" And does it help? She said, "Yeah, hot showers I do, and it helps me." And said, "You must be smoking weed." And she said, "No, I don't smoke weed." I said, "No, for sure you smoke weed." and we went back and forth, and she said, no, I do not. And because it's almost pathognomonic. I mean, literally, it's almost diagnostic. Well, so this poor lady, I dragged her through the dirt in insisting that she didn't, until she came back and said, "Look, I work for the federal government, and they drug test me monthly, and I've never been positive." So clearly there's a little more to the story than that. But the difficulty I think that we have in the clinical setting with non-pharmacologic approaches, right? So alternative medicine, self-medication type of approaches, is that the studies that we have on these kinds of approaches are limited, and the preparations are very variable. So it's very hard to conduct a good study because the CBD is a word. I mean, it's an acronym, right? But it comes in very different preparations across the country, and so it's really hard to perform a study on this.
Thank you, Art. And on that sense, in our conversations, we talk a little bit about what self-medication means for the public, and I think that for different people means different things. And I know that Mike will help us a little bit with the distinction of that. But I want to bring the conversation to Anna, because if I remember reading in like some of these, some of the general press, or in fact, at some point I remember that my mentor Roger Little mentioned to me that even the subject of obesity back in like the 70s or so, it was considered a taboo. It was more psychological, and there was really not a biological basis around this. So I know that you have a very interesting perspective on that, because you were really studying, particularly during your postdoctoral fellowship, around the reward aspect of nutrients, and then, of course, the biology of leptin. So you can tell us a little bit more about that work, where you got started.
So when I got this invitation, and the title of the conference was self-medication, I didn't really know what to think of it, because I don't directly work on the self-medication. But when I read the subtitle that you wrote on visceral decisions, then I got the flash. And of course, you were referring to my work, the work I did as a postdoctoral fellow in the lab of Jeffrey Friedman, that revolves around the idea of trying to understand how people decide what to eat. So a lot of the obesity field focused on how much people eat and what are the neural circuits responsible for how much people and animals eat, and try to manipulate those circuits so that people eat less. But there's a different dimension of eating behavior that had never been explored that much. And it relates to how decisions are taken. So why do people decide to eat what they eat, and what are the biological components that are at stake when people are making decisions about food? Now, making decisions, it's a broad area of cognitive psychology, particularly behavioral economics. And there's a lot of studies about how people decide different things about life, decisions about what to buy, decisions about how to invest money, or how do finance people decide to invest our retirement funds, for instance. So there's a lot of studies from behavioral psychology and from behavioral economics that I was back then. So this was in 2013. Back then, I was very enthusiast and curious about these studies, because they revealed to me that really we are not in control of our decisions. And there's many, many different examples of that. And I'm happy to elaborate on what was my angle into trying to understand and identifying biological circuitry.
If I can interrupt in there, Anna, actually I read from one of your articles, is it true that data shows that from over 30 years that regular Coke is actually sell like 30% or something like that more than Diet Coke? Yes. Consistently?
So my first inspiration that convinced them that there was something biological going on was in fact market data. And market data is very robust because it reflects the behavior of millions of consumers. Right, and they're subtractive of all the context-dependent confoundings of individual experimentation. And the market data does say that. It says that consumers, ever since artificial sweeteners were introduced in the market in 1947, in the form of the Sweeten Low, which still exists, it's the pink packet in the United States. Ever since those Sweeten Low was introduced in the market, that the market ratio between naturally sweetened drinks, that's sugar, and the artificially sweetened drinks is still the same. The overall trend, yeah, and the volume of sweetened drinks, of course, has increased, but the fact that this ratio is still the same tells me that there's something very robust and unchangeable about consumers' preferences. And utilizing a mouse model, we sort of mapped out the circuitry that is at stake when animals are making decisions about sugar versus artificial sweetener. And we sort of mapped out a portion of that circuitry that perhaps starts in the gut, but in the end, it gets integrated in the brain. And we analyze some of that circuitry in the brain that involves not only dopaminergic neurons, but neurons that are projecting towards the dopaminergic neurons. But in the end, it gets integrated in the brain. And we analyze some of that circuitry in the brain that involves not only dopaminergic neurons, but neurons that are projecting towards the dopaminergic neurons. And those are MCH neurons in the lateral hypothalamus.
I study in USP, Rio Grande do Sul. My question is like, even that were more options of Coca-Cola, the consumer preference hasn't changed. But one of the things that it can easily change is our appetite, what we like to eat, what we don't like to eat, and Everest. But why, even knowing that is it a herb healthier and maybe more flavorful option, why we still prefer not to change? Why we, like, even that we have the option, we prefer not?
So that's a question for me, right?
Yes, for you.
Okay, so you mentioned that our appetite is one of the easiest habits to change, and I would deeply disagree with that. If you have any data that proves otherwise, I'm happy to take a look at it. And I'd like to be convinced, but I haven't seen any data that's showing that, that the appetite is something that it's very easy to change. And it depends on what you call appetite. Do you mean how much you eat or what you eat? So my research, the idea that there's innate mechanisms, biological mechanisms that actually determines your behavior and your choices of food. So I don't think that it's very easy to change biological components in the same way that it's not easy to change the size of your nose or the length of your feet or the color of your hair.
Yeah, hi. My name is Steven Skolnick from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, Somerville. I think in like 2013 or something, a study came out and showed that you can, that there's a sort of epigenetics at play, right? That conditioning a mouse to fear a certain smell, its offspring will also know to fear that smell, and they grow more the olfactory receptor that picks it up. And so I guess, yeah, I'm wondering, you know, to what degree do you think this kind of thing might happen in humans? Are we seeing this in like taste preferences or cravings, for example? I mean, the extreme example of bringing it back to dogs is like coprophagia, right? And we see this in very sick people as well, in schizophrenia and depression. Is that self-medication? Is that, you know? So any thoughts that any of you guys have on that would be great.
Well, pica is another syndrome that is similar to coprophagia, right? And I've seen my dog doing coprophagia. It's disgusting.
Maybe they know something we don't.
But humans, they have a pica syndrome. So they eat things that are not suitable for human consumption, like chalk or stones or nails or metal things or even glass. Because there's some nutrient, or that's kind of the philosophy. I don't know if there's really a molecular explanation for this, but the paradigm that explains why patients do aberrant behaviors in terms of consumption is because they're missing something in their organism. So if you have a certain mineral deficiency or iron deficiency, then your appetite for metal increases. So that's kind of the explanation that has been given. But whether or not that's subject to epigenetic transmission, I saw the paper that you've sent in Nature Neuroscience. I'm a bit agnostic.
So I'm joining from Sidra Medicine in Qatar, and it's now midnight. So we're covering the whole world. My question was really along the lines of smell and taste. How does that, I mean, what is your take on this? How much can... Because like Anna said, you know, I also have two dogs. I've always had dogs. When my dogs go outside, right, the first thing they do when they don't feel well from the stomach is to eat the grass. But before they eat the grass, they sniff the grass, right? And they only eat a particular type. So have you seen something similar in chimps? And what are your thoughts on this overall?
Smell and taste are basically interlocked. And whether you're a traditional healer or you're an animal, I think traditional healers and the healers that I've worked with in the field in different parts of the world, when they're looking for a new plant or they're looking for a plant that's going to be effective, the first thing they do is to tear it up, smell it, and taste it. Huh. I think those are the strongest biological guideposts that animals, humans included, are making their decisions on, and that's all linked together with the brain and the stomach, and I think that's the most reliable thing that an animal has or human has to try and find out what's going to make them feel better. So taste and smell are very important, and I think that's a very strong guidepost. The social learning, the cultural part is just what in your forest has those tastes and has those smells. So the other individuals guide you towards making an easier selection, but the ground level, the biological basis for those selections, I think, are being driven by taste and smell.
Very quick. So do you think that there's an innate component to that?
Yes, definitely.
Also, I was going to make a comment along the lines. I mean, I think we're assuming that, you know, that the let's say you're trying to self-medicate because you've got a problem and the host is stable. I suspect that the host, you know, we are not stable. There's something that changes in pica. There's something that changes, you know, toxoplasmosis, right, is another one where the behavior has changed. The taste and smell are also probably not static.
Right.
And those changes, right, might be inadvertently driving behaviors as opposed to us searching out for things that will alter the steady state.
Well,
our steady state might not be steady.
Yeah, no.
It is definitely a moving, our senses. It's not like we just smell. It is that we're constantly, I mean, like,
think about COVID, right? Think COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, think smell and taste and COVID. I mean, think about that virus. Think about how that changes things. Right, so we can't assume that those patients are having the smell and taste of the same because they clearly are changed. And is that, I mean, like, not to be like all sci-fi about this, but is that a way for nature to manipulate us?
Right, it's probably
as we think that we're manipulating nature.
Yeah,
you know, and what Art brings up, I think that is really humbling, right? I think that if there is something that we have learned from this whole experience, it had really makes us. I think that a lot of things kind of fall into place, put into context, and make us more humble and appreciate what we're surrounded by. I don't know if this is a drug, but certainly I feel like this is medicine, at least for the soul. Seeing together everybody and coming together, I think that there is something to say about the social aspect.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. For more of our content, you can follow us on Twitter at GutBrains or visit our website at thinkgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts podcast would be impossible without our incredible team. Meredith Schmel is our producer and theme music composer. And special thanks to the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Borges and the Borges Institute.